On September 22nd, a Wednesday, Joe Biden summoned the two major ideological factions of his party for meetings in the Oval Office. In the space of a few hours, the president met face-to-face with a set of congressional centrists and then a group of House and Senate liberals, all with an eye toward breaking the impasse around his agenda. The centrists went first. Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were there, of course, and the House contingent included Josh Gottheimer and Stephanie Murphy. For most of the year, Manchin had been the most conspicuously challenging senator for the White House to work with, and he entered the session as one of the toughest holdouts. He had repeatedly stated his preference for a $1.5 trillion bill, a fraction of what progressives wanted. In an unusual ploy, Manchin had presented Chuck Schumer over the summer with an outline of his red lines for the reconciliation package, making explicit that he would not commit to voting for anything that cost more than $1.5 trillion. The West Virginian had asked Schumer to affix his signature to the document to confirm he had reviewed it, a tactic seemingly designed to shield Manchin against any claims later on that he had misled party leaders about what he would or would not be willing to support. But Schumer kept the document secret from other Senate Democrats, leaving them in the dark while he tried to change Manchin's mind. Democrats who negotiated with Manchin throughout the summer felt that he was stiffening his conservative instincts on certain social policies. Manchin complained to some Democrats that the child tax credit would effectively pay people to have children, when so many people in his state already had families too big for them to afford. Even more pointedly, he told Cory Booker, one of the architects of the tax credit, that he remained convinced that people would use the money for malign purposes. "Everybody just takes this check and buys drugs," Manchin claimed in one meeting of Senate Democratic leaders, prompting Booker to counter that plenty of people would use the money to buy diapers and other essentials. Manchin had been argumentative with White House aides, objecting to components of the reconciliation package that he viewed as far-left ideas foisted on the party by Bernie Sanders. Biden advisors tried to disabuse Manchin of that notion by personally emailing him an itemized list of reconciliation items that had been in the president's own campaign platform. It was a familiar and frustrating negotiation with the conservative Democrat, but it was not a hopeless one. Manchin had also been emphatic about wanting to pass a reconciliation bill with generous new spending paid for with tax increases. He believed the rich had gotten off too easy during the Trump years, and he had said so often in public. The administration was confident there was a version of the bill he would support. Biden was not sure the same could be said for everyone in the Oval Office that day. For the most part, it was a polite session. Biden had an overarching message for both factions he was meeting with that day. His administration and the party as a whole wanted both major domestic spending bills enacted, and it was up to them to figure out a way to do it. There was another tense exchange between the president and Murphy, as the Florida congresswoman told Biden he needed to do a better job calibrating liberals' sky-high expectations for the reconciliation bill. "We need you to show leadership on this," Murphy told Biden. The president grew defensive, bristling at the suggestion that he had not done so already. "I wrote this thing," Biden told Murphy. "These are my ideas, and they are popular across the country." It was a telling boast. Biden was hardly the intellectual architect of the reconciliation package. Dating back to the spring of 2020, he had borrowed many of his biggest proposals from other Democrats like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the left, and Michael Bennett and Cory Booker in the middle. But he now felt a level of ownership over the legislation that verged, in his mind, on authorship. That may have been why the president was so frustrated with Sinema for demanding that he narrow the legislation considerably, and why Biden could not help making that plain in the meeting. At one point, Biden floated a budget number for the reconciliation bill that he hoped everyone present could accept. Perhaps, Biden said, it could end up around $2 trillion. He acknowledged that Sinema was pushing for a much smaller package. In fact, Biden told the group, the Arizona senator had set her limit at $1.1 trillion. The room froze. Until then, Sinema had been a uniquely opaque character in negotiations, a far more difficult quarry than even Manchin. In private conversations, White House aides felt she often sounded more like Mitt Romney than a member of Biden's own party, telling the president that people in her state liked corporations, and she did not want to support tax policies aimed at their bottom line. Speaking with Republicans, Sinema happily boasted that she was willing to stand up to the left in ways her fellow centrist Democrats were not. She told one Republican senator she believed there were five or six other moderates who typically agreed with her on policy but preferred hiding behind my skirt. Few of her fellow Democratic senators knew her well, and Sinema abruptly left some caucus lunches when policy debates grew tense. Much of the intelligence the White House got on Sinema came from her former House colleagues, many of whom regarded her as a slippery character. To know her is not to trust her, says Hakeem Jeffries, the possible speaker-in-waiting who had entered Congress with her in 2013. The Arizona senator had refused to outline her negotiating parameters in public, as Manchin had done. That was partly because the White House had asked her not to. Biden aides believed her demands were not reasonable, and they feared that if Sinema drew a public red line at $1.1 trillion, a miserly sum by liberal standards, then the party would erupt in open war. Now Biden had exposed to some of Sinema's colleagues the very position his aides had asked her to conceal. The senator was visibly angry. "Mr. President," she said, "that was a private conversation." Sinema began to stand up. She asked Biden, "Do you want me to leave?" The president hastened to calm the situation. Of course he did not want Sinema to leave. If Biden resented her theatrics, he did not say so in the moment. He could not afford to lose her vote. Biden's meeting with a liberal delegation later that day was considerably more agreeable. With his guests arranged in a horseshoe around the Oval Office, Bernie Sanders to one side of the president and Pramila Jayapal on the other, the president listened intently as Jayapal laid out the case for holding up the infrastructure bill. Both the infrastructure deal and the reconciliation package were components of Biden's agenda, but one of them was vastly larger and more important than the other, she said. "We aren't going to allow us to leave behind 85% of your agenda," Jayapal told the president. Invoking her own family's experience immigrating from India, Jayapal told Biden that his Build Back Better agenda would restore the American dream they had crossed a world to pursue. When the meeting broke up, the president pulled Jayapal to the side. The two had struck up an unlikely political partnership since the end of the Democratic primaries, when Jayapal had energetically supported Bernie Sanders over Biden. Just the previous night, Biden had called her up to wish her a happy birthday and cheer her for an appearance on Rachel Maddow's MSNBC show. Now, in a private conversation, Biden riffled through some papers and came up with a copy of his speech to Congress earlier in the year, articulating his grand agenda for the country. "This really is my agenda," Biden said, according to Jayapal's recollection. Handing her the speech, he said, "I'd like you to have this copy." Jayapal asked the president to sign it, and Biden gladly obliged. The two most intransigent factions of Biden's party were not getting closer together, but after those meetings at the White House, it seemed that one of them was growing far closer to Biden than the other. For all the new warmth of her relationship with the president, Jayapal was keeping Biden and his advisers as hemmed in as the centrists were. The promised vote on infrastructure was now only days away, and the White House did not believe progressives were bluffing about taking down the bill. Ron Klain was adamant that the administration could not afford to let the House vote if they were likely to lose. The top Democrat in the Senate was starting to confide in allies that he worried his fellow party leaders had mishandled the situation. Chuck Schumer had taken a different view of the infrastructure and reconciliation challenge from the start. He had been telling senators, donors, and activists for months that the infrastructure deal was linked to the rest of the Democratic agenda, not just the social welfare bill, but also voting rights and other major issues. It had been a mistake for Biden to pretend otherwise, Schumer began to tell people, because it had created an unsustainable ambiguity about his priorities. He had to clear things up one way or another, or the party would never find a path forward. But in the eyes of some fellow party leaders, Schumer did not have much standing to complain about the situation. The Senate Majority Leader had receded as a force in negotiations, and members of his caucus had begun to grumble to each other that he did not seem to have a plan to to bring the two wings of his party together. Sensing that Schumer did not have a clear strategy for corralling Manchin and Sinema, Pelosi began to deal with them directly herself in an effort to reach a deal. There were only a few options left for the president and Democratic congressional leaders. One was to strike a last-minute reconciliation deal on paper and persuade the progressives to trust Manchin and Sinema to keep their commitments, thereby allowing the infrastructure bill to go through. Another option was to cancel the infrastructure vote, reneging on Pelosi's commitments to the Gottheimer gang in a concession to the power of the left. Some lawmakers hoped for a third option, an intervention by the White House to back the infrastructure bill and call on progressives to help pass it. If Biden told his party that he needed them to pass the bipartisan deal straight away, that could make it harder for the Congressional Progressive Caucus to hold together the votes to block the bill. After all, Biden was the head of his party and an architect of the infrastructure package. Perhaps it was time for him to start acting like it. But so far, Biden had not attempted to test his powers of command on the diffuse Democratic caucus. As the deadline approached, he gave no sign that he was about to change that. For at least a few days, Democratic leaders opted for delay. On Monday, September 27th, there was no infrastructure vote. Pelosi and her lieutenants urged the caucus that day to be patient. A deal with the Senate was still possible, they said, and a vote on infrastructure was imminent in any case. Holding up the bipartisan bill any longer, the speaker said, was just not a reasonable thing. In a caucus meeting, Pelosi told her members that the party was confronting a great test of its relevance, of its ability to deliver for the American people. What breaks your heart is when you knock on a door and people say, "My father didn't have a job under a Democratic president or a Republican president. What difference does it make?" Pelosi said at one point, adding, "What we talk about is essential. Does government work? Do Democrats make a difference?" Several mainstream Democrats, none of them ultimating issuing renegades on the left or in the center, spoke up during the meeting to plead with their colleagues that it was time to stop the standoff and get something done. Susie Lee, a vulnerable lawmaker from Nevada, warned that if the party failed, then we can kiss the majority goodbye for 10 years. Colin Allred, the Texas Democrat, conjured an even bleaker prospect. "We cannot let these two bills go down," Allred pleaded, "because if they go down, President Biden goes down. American democracy goes down." As September 27th came and went without a vote, the rogue moderates who had forced Pelosi to set that deadline did not rebel immediately. They had all taken heat from Democrats in their districts for their brinksmanship in August, and they did not want to risk open war with the Speaker or the White House. Besides, it seemed to them like some kind of deal really might be within reach, an agreement with Manchin and Sinema on the broad strokes of a reconciliation bill that might satisfy House progressives enough for them to let the infrastructure bill go through. But dealing with Manchin and Sinema was not getting any easier for Biden's team. On September 28th, between negotiating sessions at the White House, Kristen Sinema held an afternoon fundraiser with a collection of Republican-leaning business groups, including lobbies for the grocery and roofing industries. Several of the organizations had spoken out against the reconciliation bill. In a space above the Capitol Hill pub Bullfeathers, Sinema showed them exactly why Biden found her so exasperating. There were parts of the reconciliation package she liked, Sinema told the group. She liked its biggest climate measures, and she liked some of the social programs, such as the child tax credit. But Sinema expressed intense skepticism of taxation and spending overall, and played up her differences with the rest of her party. "I come from a fiscally conservative state," she said, "and I'm interested in maintaining pro-growth tax policies that ensure that we can get through this pandemic without losing ground." To the delight of her audience, Sinema sounded more like a Republican as she went on. "Arizonans don't like taxes, and we don't really like government. We love our country, and we love our military, and that's about where it ends." Had Sinema's Democratic colleagues been in the room, they might have been startled to hear her speaking warmly about several House Republicans whom Democrats regarded as among the worst of Donald Trump's henchmen. Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, she said, were friends of mine, Andy Biggs, a far-right lawmaker from Arizona who had peddled outrageous lies about the 2020 election, was a dear friend. "I love Andy Biggs," Sinema said. "I know some people think he's crazy, but that's just because they don't know him." Her remarks went unreported at the time, but Sinema did not spare her Democratic Senate colleagues, complaining that Bernie Sanders had stoked House progressives' blockade of the infrastructure bill and speaking dismissively about Ron Wyden, the Oregon Democrat who chaired the Senate Finance Committee. In a final insult, Sinema could not resist tweaking Biden before the supportive crowd. Aside from his talks with Democrats, the president was also locked in a standoff with Mitch McConnell over an upcoming deadline for Congress to raise the statutory limit on government debt. The Republican leader was insisting that Democrats raise the debt ceiling without any help from the Senate GOP. Biden called that position irresponsible. But Biden, Sinema mused, did not exactly have clean hands on the issue. "Many of my colleagues, including the president, have at one time or another voted against the debt limit," she said. "Perhaps that makes it a little bit harder for folks to be, you know, kind of righteous on the issue." She did not sound like a senator moving toward a deal. By Thursday, September 30th, it was clear to the main negotiators that there was not going to be a breakthrough on the reconciliation package. Democratic leaders had to decide what to do about the infrastructure vote that was already 3 days overdue. They had delayed a day of reckoning with their own internal divisions for about as long as they could. There were a few centrist Democrats who wanted to take a vote even if it meant losing. Josh Gottheimer believed it would be useful to members in swing districts to vote for the infrastructure bill even if progressives blocked it, so that they could tell voters back home that they had stood up for jobs and bipartisanship. In a leadership meeting that Thursday, Steny Hoyer echoed that view with a sigh. "I know no one agrees with me," Hoyer said, "but I think we should take the vote." The Speaker of the House believed she had a better option than either losing or pulling the vote. She had kept another plan secret from members, but seemed to show her hand in a meeting with the centrist New Democrat Coalition on Thursday. Pelosi was holding sessions with the major ideological factions in her caucus, trying to keep people calm and divine a way forward. The New Democrats were as confused as anyone about how the current standoff would get resolved. At one point, Pelosi leaned over to Chrissy Houlihan, the leader of the moderate group, and touched her elbow as though she were about to share a confidence. "Your idea of bringing Biden here, that could happen," Pelosi said, according to Houlihan's memory. The Pennsylvania lawmaker had not actually suggested to the speaker that she bring in Biden, but Houlihan took it as a reference to the wishes of the group. Pelosi knew that many centrist Democrats were holding on to hope that Biden might show up on the Hill and give the House caucus a stirring pep talk that would sweep his infrastructure bill into law. Pelosi was leaning into the idea that this might really happen. So was Steve Ricchetti. The Biden advisor was sensitive to the tangled dynamics of the president's wide-ranging agenda, but he had always believed that getting infrastructure done would only strengthen Biden's hand with Congress. Manchin and Sinema had grown harder to deal with during the protracted standoff, not easier, in part because of their resentment toward House liberals holding up the infrastructure bill. Ricchetti had gone as far as asking his old boss, Bill Clinton, a Democrat who spoke centrism as his native tongue, to help him lobby Manchin and Sinema. The former president had not managed to move either one of them. Ricchetti knew, too, from his contacts in the House, that support among Republicans for the infrastructure bill was plunging. After winning 19 GOP votes in the Senate, the bill was at risk of winning less than half that support among House Republicans, just as Kevin McCarthy had predicted. In the Senate vote, no less a Republican partisan than Mitch McConnell had been able to claim that the infrastructure deal was distinct from the rest of Biden's agenda. Now the linkage was all too apparent. Some Republican House members open to voting in favor were surprised that the White House was not reaching out to seek their help. Even GOP lawmakers with a record of taking on the right, like Fred Upton and Adam Kinzinger, heard nothing from the president. That treatment was reserved for a few select Senate Republicans. On Wednesday night, September 29th, Biden had attended the congressional baseball game, cheerfully greeting lawmakers on the diamond at Nationals Park. He sat for a time with Andy Levin, and the liberal lawmaker came away convinced that the president was not interested in strong-arming progressives or speeding up a vote on infrastructure. "This is your agenda," Levin recalls telling him, "and we're sticking up for it." Biden replied with a message of encouragement. "I know it," the president said, according to Levin, "and I appreciate it." On Friday, October 1st, Ricchetti told one member of Congress that the president was likely headed for Capitol Hill in a matter of hours. White House aides had been drafting remarks for Biden to make to the Democratic caucus, leaning in hard to the value and urgency of passing the infrastructure bill. "Pelosi wants him to come in and close the deal," Ricchetti told this lawmaker. In a meeting of the Democratic caucus on Friday morning, some lawmakers spoke up to deplore the bleeding fissures within their own party. Lois Frankel, a 73-year-old Democrat from South Florida, lamented that there seemed to be total war between these different caucuses and factions, even though, in reality, the differences are slender. Another, Sarah Jacobs, a 32-year-old freshman from Southern California, invoked the attack of January 6th in a plea for unity. "I literally almost died with 20 of you across the ideological spectrum," Jacobs said. "The insurrectionists didn't care if you were in the Blue Dogs or the Progressives, I'll tell you that." Hakeem Jeffries, too, sought to direct his party's ire outward, toward the GOP. The most important division at the Capitol, he said, was patriots versus traitors. The Speaker of the House did not signal she was about to bring in Joe Biden in a bid to unify her party behind the infrastructure bill. While Pelosi said it was time to move ahead with the legislation, "It's very important for this bill to pass today," she said. The speaker sounded highly sympathetic to her party's progressive wing and its grievances. They did not like being pushed around by hostage-taking centrists in the House or the Senate, and neither did Pelosi. Those centrists, Pelosi told her caucus, had forced her to promise a vote and then reneged on their side of the bargain. In her telling, Pelosi had struck a simple deal with them in August. She would promise to bring up infrastructure for a vote by September 27th, and they would promise to vote for a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. But then, the speaker claimed, moderates had broken that deal, teaming up with Sinema and Manchin to shrink and revise the reconciliation package in a way that delayed the process. "We read in the paper that there are members of our caucus joining with members of the Senate that reject the 3.5," Pelosi said. "The very same people who are demanding a vote on a certain day are making it impossible for us to have a vote on a certain day." There were uncomfortable murmurs going up in the room, getting louder as the speaker went on. "I'm just stating fact," Pelosi said, adding, "This is a family discussion. Families can get rough sometimes." To the moderates Pelosi was deriding, it was a very rough family discussion indeed. The speaker was mischaracterizing the deal she had made. Gottheimer and his group of nine had never committed to support a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, along the precise lines Pelosi envisioned. They had agreed to support the $3.5 trillion budget resolution, an important intermediate measure. But they had all understood that the final deal on reconciliation was a work in progress. Pelosi had known that in August. She surely knew it on October 1st, too. Within the centrist group, it felt like Pelosi was trying to make them take the fall for the chaos of the week. Carolyn Bordeaux, the Georgia freshman, texted the other eight members of the Gottheimer-led moderate bloc before the meeting adjourned. "Oh, dear Lord, this whole thing is going to collapse," she wrote. Kurt Schrader, the Oregon centrist who had voted to keep Pelosi as speaker because he saw her as a safeguard against the far left, wrote back in biting language. The former veterinarian had never intended to vote for a multi-trillion-dollar reconciliation bill at all. Pelosi's claim was absurd. "Truly a terrible person," Schrader said of the most powerful Democrat in the House. A third lawmaker, Jared Golden of Maine, reported that he had tracked down Steny Hoyer. According to Golden, Pelosi's longtime deputy had looked directly at Golden and said of the speaker's remarks, "That's bullshit." Yet Golden also mused that perhaps there was a method to Pelosi's apparent madness. Perhaps, he suggested, Pelosi was blaming their little crew for the mess at hand as a way of placating progressives before she asked them to do something they did not want to do, vote for the infrastructure bill. so she can't take the embarrassment, so she tells them we screwed her, and now the whole caucus has to pass the BIF, Golden said, using an acronym for Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework to refer to the infrastructure bill. In a sign of the distrustful mood gripping Democrats, the young Marine from Maine speculated that perhaps Pelosi would hold a vote and root for the progressives to block it. Maybe she hopes it fails, he wrote. Nancy Pelosi was not planning to lose a vote on the infrastructure bill, and the President of the United States was not going to Capitol Hill to watch his cherished bipartisan deal disintegrate. As word spread of Biden's plan to meet with House Democrats, a surge of optimism rippled through the centrist wing of his party, and party leaders were projecting a full-speed-ahead attitude about the vote. Speaking with reporters at the Capitol, Hakeem Jeffries publicly predicted that the infrastructure bill would pass into law within 24 hours. Anticipating a possible shift in the stalemated negotiations, Pramila Jayapal announced that the Congressional Progressive Caucus would meet after Biden addressed House Democrats. If the president came down hard on liberals with a demand to pass his infrastructure bill, they would have to regroup quickly. Before Biden left the White House, he conferred one last time with Mike Donilon, his longtime political advisor and speechwriter, about what he wanted to say. The president was clear about the message he planned to deliver, but on the Hill, there was a swirl of rumor and speculation. Ricchetti's description of Biden's intent was spreading quickly, but that was just one advisor's confidential description of the situation, and the White House had not formally notified its negotiating partners of what Biden was going to do. Jayapal reached out to Ron Klain ahead of Biden's speech. She asked the chief of staff, "What is he going to say?" "I think you'll like it," Klain replied, without elaborating further. Jayapal did not think Klain would have said that to her if Biden was about to twist progressives' arms on the infrastructure bill. Klain himself was intensely skeptical that strong-arming the left would get the infrastructure bill passed that day. In the White House's whip count, there were still about 32 Democrats who planned to vote no on the bill, including 15 whose position could be more accurately described as hell no. The chief of staff did not want Biden to go all out for the legislation and then lose. Neither did the president. By the time Biden entered a spacious conference room in the Capitol basement around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Democrats were braced for a moment of political climax. The president of the United States was in their midst, standing before the same flags and mahogany-colored paneling where House Democrats were accustomed to seeing their own leaders and committee chairs. Surely, a decisive moment was at hand. Or perhaps not. Biden addressed them in broad and encouraging terms. He wanted to pass both the infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill, the president said. He knew the vast majority of them did too. They were on their way to making transformational change in America. The policies they were putting forward, immense new benefits for children and families, the elderly and the sick, and the largest ever investments in clean energy and decarbonization would rank among the great achievements of the Democratic Party over the centuries. But Biden reminded them he lacked the huge congressional majorities that other transformational Democratic presidents had enjoyed. Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson had not been working with an evenly split Senate and a 4-seat margin in the House. The party would have to compromise to get what it wanted, Biden added. He believed he had support for his entire domestic agenda from 48 senators, but there were two he had not yet been able to bring along. Concessions would have to be made. That would take some more time, and the infrastructure bill would have to wait. The president had decided October 1st was not the day to demand a vote. Biden did not say when he hoped to reach terms with the Senate holdouts, or what those terms might be, or when he expected to hold a vote on the infrastructure bill. If Biden had a plan, he did not share it. The president did share a story about Satchel Paige, the legendary black pitcher who played baseball deep into his 40s in a career that spanned the integration of Major League Baseball. Paige, Biden said, had once been asked about his capacity to play at such an advanced age. The pitcher's retort had been that age was an abstraction. "How old would you be," he supposedly asked, "if you did not know how old you were?" It was not clear what message Biden intended to convey with that story. Some members had heard it from him before, in the more appropriate venue of the Democratic dugout at the congressional baseball game the previous night. As lawmakers filed out of the meeting room Friday after an anticlimactic presidential address, Biden's yarn about an aging pitcher was not altogether reassuring. On their way out of the building, Biden and Pelosi strolled past a throng of reporters who bellowed questions at the president about when he would get his agenda passed. "We're going to get this done," Biden said, raising his outstretched hands to shoulder level in an appeal for calm. "It doesn't matter when. It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done." The president's speech did not resolve the standoff within his own party, but in an odd way, it managed to diffuse some of the accumulated tension around Pelosi's deadline and infrastructure. By declining to demand a vote, Biden shouldered some of the blame for missing that checkpoint. The group of nine was still mad at the speaker, but that anger was diluted somewhat by their confusion about the president's role. Pelosi was angry, too, and in private she vented about the progressive blockade that had forced her to cancel the infrastructure vote. She told another House Democrat that Jayapal and Ocasio-Cortez were vying to be the queen bee of the left, but that their reward might be serving in the House minority after the next election. Progressives, though, took Biden's appearance in the Capitol as a validation of their position. No vote on infrastructure until there was a reconciliation deal in place. The president, Jayapal exulted on MSNBC, affirmed the need to do both bills together and made it clear that where we are is that we will not be able to do the infrastructure bill without the reconciliation bill. Yes, she allowed, Biden had affirmed the need to trim back the legislation to win over the Senate holdouts, but in the process, he had effectively aligned himself with the left. The weekend after Biden's speech, an odd calm settled over the surface of the party. With the September 27th deadline on infrastructure voided, Democrats were no longer captive to a maddening set of interlocking procedural and policy disagreements. In theory, they could take a few weeks just to focus on the substance of their negotiations. Surely, many of them believed, the party would be able to converge on some number and some set of programs that everyone from Jayapal to Sinema could agree on. As Biden said, it might only be a matter of time. Or it might not. For some lawmakers, however, time was a precious commodity. It was one thing for the president and congressional leaders to let negotiations drag on indefinitely. Most of them were at the end of their careers, focused on cementing their legacies. Pelosi herself had raised eyebrows at a news conference when she described the reconciliation bill as a culmination of my service in Congress, the closest she had ever come even to implying that the end was near. The long delays were also safe enough for Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who did not have to face the voters again until 2024, and for Jayapal, who held a solidly Democratic seat, to engage in a months-long staring contest. There was no chance they would face repudiation in the midterms. But scores of other Democrats were anticipating difficult re-election campaigns in 2022. If the party wanted to shape the political landscape with massive legislative achievements, then the negotiations could not go on forever and ever. Already, candidates in the 2021 off-year elections feared they would suffer from the deadlock in Washington. Terry McAuliffe, the former Virginia governor seeking to reclaim his old job, was repeatedly calling his friend Ricchetti with pleas to get the infrastructure bill done and buck up the president's approval rating. On October 5th, 4 days after his visit to the Hill, Biden gathered yet another group of House Democrats for a meeting, this time in a virtual setting. It was a contingent chosen specifically for their political vulnerability. All were so-called frontliners, lawmakers from marginal seats whose victory or defeat in 2022 would likely determine control of Congress. They were Democrats enveloped in political danger. They were also Democrats who had been on the front lines of danger on January 6th. Joining Biden for the meeting were Susan Wild and Lizzie Fletcher, survivors of the House Gallery evacuation, and Lauren Underwood, who had been locked out of her own office without a phone as rioters rampaged through the Capitol. There was Colin Allred, the former football player who had brandished a metal pole in self-defense, and Abigail Spanberger, the former intelligence officer who had warned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the days before January 6th that she should dress in plain clothes for her own safety. The meeting was mainly about the two pending pieces of domestic legislation, and Biden asked the members to lay out their priorities for the reconciliation bill. Spanberger, for one, told him that the final version ought to focus on climate change, the child tax credit, and lowering the cost of prescription drugs, a recommendation that reflected something of an emerging consensus among left-of-center Democrats in the House and Senate. But to some members of this group, the fine details of the reconciliation package mattered somewhat less than the urgent imperative that Democrats finish the deal, and fast. Voicing the feelings of many Democratic colleagues, Colin Allred stressed to Biden that if Democrats did not prove that they could make government work, then the party and the country would pay an awful price. The alternative is a Republican Party that doesn't believe in democracy in the same way, Allred told Biden, according to his memory. It was Susan Wild, the last member to speak, who most thoroughly addressed the raw politics of the moment. The Pennsylvania litigator had been a voice of straight talk throughout her 2 years and 10 months in the House, criticizing Biden's slothful campaign, urging Pelosi to stop holding show votes on legislation that would never pass the Senate, and sharply rebuking the White House for the summer disaster in Afghanistan. Now she was face to face with the President of the United States, albeit in a video meeting. Wild chose her language carefully. During the long season of negotiation and posturing between Democrats in Washington, the White House had not done all that much to promote its achievements or sell the contents of the reconciliation bill to the American people. Addressing Biden, Wild said it was time for all that to change. Voters needed to know that the administration was about to deliver meaningful and specific benefits for them, not just the amount of money it was about to spend. Just as important, Wild said, Biden had to spend more time explaining to voters how the legislation would be paid for. Many Democrats, including the president and the Speaker of the House, had been pushing the line that the reconciliation bill would not cost a nickel, a glib and inarticulate way of expressing that taxes on corporations and the wealthy would cover the cost. Wild said voters were incredulous when they heard that a multi-trillion-dollar bill would not cost them anything. They needed to be persuaded that it was true. The more people can understand it, the more they're able to sift through the opposition's talking points and recognize them for being false, Wild said by her own recollection. That candid moment with the president represented a painful reality check on many of the political aspirations of Biden and his team. They had begun the year by boasting that they would move faster, fight harder, and sell their accomplishments more aggressively than Barack Obama ever did. Now it was autumn, and a vulnerable member of the House, one with down-to-earth Pennsylvania roots like his own, was telling the president things had not yet worked out that way. Biden did not get defensive or argue with Wild. In fact, the president agreed with her. "I feel the same way," Biden replied, according to Wild. "We've been talking about this. We really need to change some of our messaging." To the whole group, Biden made a larger commitment. On that autumn day, 11 months after he defeated Donald Trump at the ballot box, Biden acknowledged that the fight for control of the country was about to go to the voters once again. His domestic agenda was still hanging in the balance on Capitol Hill, but the ultimate fate of his presidency would be decided in the midterm elections. "I know that I need all of you," Biden told his guests. "I know that I need you all to hold your seats in order for the second 2 years of my term to be productive." The president promised, "I'm going to be there for all of you." The next campaign was already approaching.